Robert Pruitt is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Pruitt to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, with criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Paige Yannick. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Dave Atwood. Houston Vigil reporter, Jennifer Simmons, and we'll air an interview with Pruitt taped recently on death row. The execution watch for Robert Pruitt begins. People, don't you know they're killing? People, don't you know they're killing people?
I am Ray Hill. The name of the show is Execution Watch. It is Wednesday, October the 12th, 2017. And tonight, Texas is scheduled, Thursday the 12th. Tonight, Texas is killing a friend of mine, and his name is Robert Pruitt. I have been working on this case now for 6 or 7 years. I've interviewed Robert 5 times. Every time he has gotten the date, he has allowed me to come do an interview, and I have watched the progression of him over that period of time and the effects of the Damocles sword swinging over his head all that time. I understand Dave Atwood is in Huntsville, so hello, Dave.
Hey, Ray. I'm here.
What's going on in Huntsville?
Well, Ray, we've got about, I'm guessing about close to 20 people out here protesting the execution of Robert. I see witnesses going across the street right now, actually. And so they're proceeding from the administration building over to the prison where the execution chamber is.
Well, and just a minute, David, let me explain to the listeners that the word we try to get from Austin is, are the witnesses crossing the road or are they not? If they are crossing that road, that means that Robert is on the gurney. He has been strapped down. There are needles in his vein, and the state is preparing to proceed with this procedure, as they call it.
Correct. And they are going across. So what you describe is the exact situation. You know, this place, this corner next to the prison is, to me, one of the worst places I've ever visited, and I've been up here many times, and it's just hard to be here to see this killing continue by the state of Texas. It's just very, very difficult to be here and to see it happen again.
Well, it's hard on us here in the studio because none of us want to do this show, but we think that there's a journalistic obligation to do it, and so we do it. And so all of us are suffering through our individual, dancing with our individual ghosts at a time like this. I understand the Journey for Life is in the state.
Yep, the Journey of Hope is starting off on Saturday with a movie, but they're up here today. Well, we've got part of the group. There's about 20 of them in the Journey of Hope.
Yeah.
And today there's, I guess, about half dozen of them, including Bill Pelkey, who's the president, and George White, who's the co-president, plus a number of other people.
Well, Bill's an institution in the movement, and give them all our regards, would you?
I sure will, definitely.
And thank you, Dave. I'm going to get Jennifer on the air, and I will proceed from there.
All righty. You take care.
Thank you, sir.
Yep.
Jennifer, are you on?
Yes, there you are. Yes, Ray, I am out here in front of St. Paul's Methodist Church at the corner of Main and Bend in the Museum District. Very hot, humid night here. We have several people. You know, we haven't met since July was the last execution, and that's a good thing and a bad thing. It's good that we're not executing people more frequently. It's bad that we become complacent and it falls off our radar screen. But we are here tonight, a few of us, very, very busy intersection. People coming and going from the museum, food trucks nearby, young people sitting and drinking at tables, having a great time. So it's very tragic that we are standing here in all this happy corner, and I think this is a particularly tragic vigil that we're having here tonight.
And this is put together by the Texas Coalition. Could you explain what that is?
Well, we are the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. We work on one issue only, and that's the abolition of the death penalty in Texas. We have an executive office in Austin, and we have chapters and groups all over Texas, and many of them are out having their own vigils at this time. So they can go to the website, tcadp.org, and I heard Dave talk about the Journey of Hope that will come here on Friday. Well, actually, they're here now. They can go to that website, and under Get Involved, Attend Events, they will see a list of the public events that are open to the public that the Journey is putting on, and there are some very interesting events coming up, one with Pam Ogg on Tuesday night. So that might be something people might want to look into attending.
All right, Jennifer, we're going to proceed with the show. We'll all know what happens, but the witnesses across the road, the procedure has begun.
Oh, the procedure, that is horrible news. I'm very, very sorry to hear that. Thank you very much, Ray.
Thank you for your report.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, this is difficult for me because, as I said earlier, Robert and I are friends, and I'd go visit him, and we would bond. The first time I went to visit him, he didn't shave. His hair was a mess. His posture was deplorable. He didn't know whether he wanted to be there. But Mark and I showed up with cameras and a microphone, and he began to relax. The second time I went to visit him, he had shaved. His hair was combed. He got a new haircut. He knew I was coming. You know in advance I was coming. And he tries to tidy up. We went this last time, and he actually apologized because death row had been on lockdown, and he didn't have an access to a barber or a shave. I've got enough material in the can. And after tonight's show, I am free to do with that material what I want to. And I want to make a documentary out of Robert's progression on the row, where we tell his story in total. I do not think he did it. I had a visit, after I visited Robert, with David Dow, his attorney, who does not think he did it. But if the witnesses have crossed the road, he will be dead in a few minutes. Paige, what happened in this case?
Well, here's what happened. Robert had ended up in TDC as a result of a killing that he accomplished when he was 15 years old.
He didn't actually do the killing.
No, he actually didn't. He was not the killer, the person with the knife, the gun, whatever. It wasn't he. However, his father was the actual killer. His brother was involved in it as well. And he, being the younger child, went along with whatever familial program was in play.
It was kind of a Channel View neighborhood fight.
Yes, indeed. It appears it was a Channel View neighborhood fight. It appears that the father had been looking for a reason to get back at the neighbor who became the victim, the ultimate mm-hmm. victim. And he found one when his dogs barked suddenly in the middle of the night once. And that was a call to arms. And he called his sons to arms. And although,
He was 15
at the time. Although Robert hung back, I mean, he ran out of the house. He threatened the victim, and then he hung back. And it appears that his father and his brother chased the victim into the woods, and they and only they know what happened.
But that's not why we're here.
No, it's not. So he was sentenced to 99 years on this murder that he participated in as a party when he was 15 years old. And in 1999, was it? While he is on death row in Beeville, he...
Not on death row, in prison.
Well,
prison.
He was in prison, excuse me.
99 years don't get you on death row.
No, he had 99 years in a sentence. He did not have death. I'm sorry. But he had already been convicted of murder as a co-defendant. And he was sentenced to 99 years. And he was in the Beeville prison unit. And he was ultimately charged with the death of a guard.
Sullivan Newman Nagle.
Yes.
He was a Union Guard, Union steward, actually.
Yes. The guard Nagle was a Union representative. And he had an issue with Nagle about testifying and about things going on in the jail.
Well, Nagle had an issue with a bunch of people about that testifying, but the issue between Robert and Nagle was a peanut butter sandwich.
Well, that was true. The thing that provoked it all was the fact that Robert walked out onto the yard with a peanut butter sandwich that day. Nagle, the guard, came up to him and told him, no, he couldn't eat the peanut butter sandwich on the yard. He had to take it
rules
back.
Rules are rules.
Yeah, rules are rules. You have to take it back inside. And there was an issue between them, but it seemed to be like a shoving, pushing match. And then later, much later in the afternoon, Nagle's body was discovered in
the gym.
The gym, in the bathroom in the gym, in hidden by a half partition. And then
Nagle had been killed with a sharpened piece of rebar. And let me tell you something. I don't know how many people you've killed with rebar. I killed just a few. But the trouble is not getting the rebar in. The trouble is getting the rebar out, because rebar has dimples and creases, and the body tends to cling to that. So if you got a sharpened piece of rebar and you stab somebody with it, it takes a good bit of force, more force to get it in, to pull it out. He was stabbed 9 times.
Yes, indeed he was. And ultimately, the state's attorney convinced the people in prison who were other prisoners to testify against Nagle. And no one claimed to be witnesses at the very time it occurred. Nobody saw anything happen. And it's not even clear that Nagle was anywhere in the area. He could have been out on the yard when it occurred.
Pruitt,
excuse me.
Paige, when you go to Wreck in the afternoon and you go to the gym as opposed to the yard, if you go to the yard, you don't have access to the gym.
Okay.
If you go to the gym, you don't have access to the yard. And to get in the gym, there is a door in front of the gym, and there is an officer, not an inmate. We used to have turnkeys back in my day, but they don't have turnkey inmates anymore. You have an officer to open that door. And as I understand it, Nagle was in where the officers use the bathroom, which is separated from the rest of the building by a lower wall, so that the officers can go in there and still keep an eye on the area for security reasons.
It was sort of a half wall.
Yeah, half wall. On the other side of the gym is the same half-wall situation for the inmates. They can go in there, but the wall keeps them from disappearing, so you can see them in there, at least in the more respectable parts of them in the other room. And so it's that's the way it was designed. And Nagel was behind the half wall on the guard side.
And yes, that is where his body was found.
And there was blood everywhere.
Yes.
Because the very nature of stabbing somebody with a piece of rebar is going to produce a lot of blood. So not only was there blood on the walls and there is no ceiling in there, but the walls and the floors and spattered on both sides of the walls, blood everywhere, and Nagel's uniform was covered in blood. And how much blood did Robert have on him?
Robert Pruitt had a small, single drop of blood on the left front of his shirt.
Did they do DNA on that stuff?
No, they never did.
As a matter of fact, they did blood serum tests on the blood on Nagel's shirt. I mean, they did serum tests on all the blood. But on Robert's shirt, they did a serum test and to tell whether it was A, B, or O negative, whatever it was. The test on that shirt would have matched the profile of about a third of the people on that unit, officers and inmates. Yeah, I get a lot of information from David Dow. And so the deal is that I do not believe that Robert committed this crime. In the first place, there'd have been a lot more blood on Robert. In the gym, he doesn't have access to a shower, so he can't tidy up. He doesn't have access to his clothes with his name on it. I mean, he walked out of there, his shirt with his name on it, and a small drop of blood. He explained it because he'd cut his finger. Cut his finger earlier. So that's the situation, the fact situation in this case. Nagel, just one of the things that Page began to talk about, is Nagel had scheduled to testify before the grand jury as a union advocate against officers who were involved with prison gangs for smuggling. Tobacco's contraband, drugs are contraband. And apparently some officers were cooperating with gangs so they could get paid, cooperating in the smuggling thing. And Nagel was a by-the-book kind of guy. And he was going to testify against that before a grand jury. That very same grand jury indicted the investigating officer in this case and three other people for smuggling. And they indicted Robert Pruitt for the murder of Nagel. Same grand jury.
Yes, sir.
That cover it?
Yeah, that does everybody.
All right. Larry, your investigator is an officer with potential of having an interest in the case, so you don't have a neutral investigator in this case.
Exactly, Ray. And the case troubles me quite a bit. I know we've discussed, we believe in our system, or we pride ourselves in the fact that our system is a system of laws and not of men, but men administer those laws. And my concern is how men exercise their discretion in the administration of the laws. Now, I've spoken a lot about how the prosecutor decides whether to seek the death penalty or not. I'm not really overly concerned about prosecutorial discretion in this case because it was pretty much a done deal. You're in a prison town, and a prison guard gets killed. So whoever they believe is responsible for it is going to get the death penalty. They're going to seek the death penalty mainly because when we look at death penalty cases, we talk about the fact that what should you do with somebody who commits a heinous act? Does it do our society a whole lot of good to spend money seeking the death penalty because you can just put him in prison for the long time, the rest of his life, and then what? But the fact is, there is a society inside prison.
Yes.
And this case underscores that. I mean, after all, Pruitt was already in prison for 99 years.
Yes.
And so the claim is
and a peanut butter case is a minor case. This is not a big, serious problem that he hadn't dealt with before many times.
And it just doesn't make a lot of sense. Now, this case was developed as a word-on-the-yard kind of case. Word on the yard was that, you know, this is the way the prison guard was killed. And so what the state has the luxury of doing is that, because they can give ideals, is they can get inmates to come in and testify as to what they claimed happened.
Oh, did we ever learn that in the Eroy Brown trial, where the Eroy Brown killed the warden and the field major, and I worked with the defense on that case. But, you know, when we ended the first trial in a hung jury, and we brought those lying inmates back, they couldn't remember the story they told in the first trial, and we had the transcript.
And unfortunately, that's just kind of the way it is, because these inmates, I understand, recanted later. But at trial, the discretionary issue I'd like to discuss most about, focus on.
But before you get into the discretionary issue, all right, suppose I'm a cop. And suppose my wife runs over the neighbor's dog. Am I the person they send out to investigate that case?
No. Well, they shouldn't.
Of course not.
They shouldn't, but they can. and that's the problem. And in this case, when it goes to trial, the judge decides what comes in evidence and what does not. And so the inmates were allowed to testify fairly freely that, you know, I saw Pruitt kill Nagel. And that was all over the transcript. But when the defense tries to develop its theory of the case, that is that really Pruitt was set up, and that Nagel was preparing to testify against prison officials. And that was his a major part of his defensive theory. The judge shut it down. Said, that does not come in. When he brings a witness on, said this witness is going to testify to this, that, or the other, the judge says, well, I don't see the connection. And so the judge has total discretion as to what comes in and what does not.
The judge actually heard that evidence, but it wasn't out of the presence of the jury.
In order to
exactly.
to consider whether that evidence comes in, the defense was required to present the evidence to the court outside the presence of the jury for the judge to decide whether it comes in or not. And so the defense got shut down repeatedly on its proffer of evidence was shown to be not persuasive enough to allow it was going to confuse the jury if that evidence were to come in. That was the judge's perspective, and because the judge has discretion to decide what comes in and what does not come in, the judge's actions are reviewed by the higher court on an abuse of discretion
but
basis.
But isn't generally deference given to the trial judge? Generally?
The trial judge is the referee, and he makes the calls of the balls and strikes. So, yes, I mean, the trial judge is there. He sees the witnesses. He is appellate courts tend not to want to in terms of the evidence in the case, what comes in and what does not come in. The appellate courts tend not to want to second guess the judge. They don't want to put themselves in the position of a judge unless the rulings of the judge are clearly seen to be an abuse of discretion.
We're going to stop there, and we're going to hear an interview with Robert Pruitt, which was taped just a couple of weeks ago. Go ahead, Bob. Robert, it gets scarier and scarier for me. How do you handle it?
It's life to me, just like I said. You know, it's I look at all this stuff as just like a kind of like an exercise in practicing awareness and being present in the moment. You know, no matter how intense it gets, it's to me it's an exercise. You know, it's a challenge to stay focused and stay present. You know what I mean? And with each and every step, no matter which way it goes, you know. So what do they say? Kind of used to it a little bit too, you know.
Yeah, you get a lot of practice.
Again, I'm having a lot of practice with it.
When I send you messages through Young and other people, that do you get them?
They do come. They do come. Yes, they do. Did you get my letter? Did you happen to get my letter, the yes. last one where I was? Yeah.
Yes, I did get your letter, and thank you. I always thank you for your lamb saving them. And
for the documentary later, right? After I'm exonerated?
I can make a documentary out of we've got in the can. As a matter of fact, Mark and I were discussing that on the way up here. He's probably not the person to do it because he's too invested to, and you need an objective documentary filmmaker. But we discussed the effect of making films and how that affects people psychologically. And I can see that in photographs of you and videotape of you.
That it's affected me in a positive way? Oh, that I've affected others.
The audience.
Yeah.
Actually, Mark's words, making film is like dealing drugs. You're showing them pictures and images and giving them concepts that's going to make their bodies produce all these dopamines and this adrenaline and right. all that.
It's a very emotional situation, you know.
And it's chemical. It's chemical. It's in the body chemical. We've talked about everything I can think of to talk about. But I do want to ask you a favor.
Okay.
If we get down to the last minute, send me the last chance you get. Send me a kite.
Okay, I mean, I can do that.
Send me a kite.
Well, we're getting pretty close.
Billy Hughes sent me a kite, and I treasure it.
You have, I wrote you the last time at KPFT.
Yeah, it doesn't make any difference.
Is the P.O. box still good? The same?
Both of them are good. No, nothing ever changes. I can't get rid of that P.O. box. The cops murdered Fred Pies. And that was his post office box. I ain't giving up their number. Y'all killed me first.
Okay, so I do still have that then. I do still have that. I was curious if I wasn't sure if it still worked.
If you send it to the post office box, I'll get it for sure as soon as it gets there.
Okay, cool. I'll definitely write you one, handwritten. Okay.
How's the atmosphere on the road? People dealing with it?
We're locked down right now, and it's, it's hit or miss these days. Who's going to get a stay and who isn't, you know? Yeah. And the captain asked me the other day, he's like, how does it look? You're going to, you know, you're... I said, well, you know, I've seen people with solid issues, claims, and legitimate innocence claims get executed. And I've seen people with clearly they've done their murder and they've admitted to it and get stays, you know. And so it's just, you just never know.
Yeah. It's been a couple of, you know, that you wouldn't think, but they wound up with stays for any number of reasons, some directly related to the case and some not.
I mean, it just depends. It really depends on how the judge feels that day. I mean, that's really how it is, man, because when you look at the issues and you compare the case to case, and they don't treat like cases alike. That's some kind of myth, you know, that they're supposed to. That they want them to treat like cases alike, but they don't do that. Of course, they don't do
well,
that.
Well, the watchers of the documentary?
Right.
Hopefully not the watchers of this interview on my
website. Right.
We'll know that on my website, all of those interviews.
They're there.
Every one of them.
They'll be there like if I'm executed?
Haven't thrown away a sentence. Even when Lurch sat where you were sitting and told me I was full of crap and the prison show and execution wise were just a waste of time.
Who told you that?
Lurch.
Yeah.
But you know.
He had a hard time with this.
Get 100,000 hits. On the international web of Lurch's interview.
Wow.
Woods.
Stephen Wood?
Yeah, Stephen Wood. He was the first one to be broadcast.
I remember that one,
he's
too.
He's over 100,000.
Crazy.
And Garza. Everybody that we've interviewed has been exposed to audiences all over the world.
Yes.
Tell me about Teresa.
She's beautiful in every way, inside and out. I'm really lucky to have met her, you know. I mean,
how'd you meet her?
She's seen one of them interviews I'd done, you know, BBC, and she works at a place and met a girl who happens to visit somebody here on death row, and the girl told her, hey, well, you could write him too if you wanted to, you know, he'll probably write. So yeah, and of course I did write her back, and it's pretty magical after that.
And she's from England?
Yes, she's from England.
But she's here now.
She's here now, yes.
Yeah, she told me she was coming down early for the duration. So
yeah, she's here. She's here through all that.
Do you hear from your family?
I got to see my dad. You know, my dad killed my neighbor in my first case, and he was one of the evacuees from Rosharon that was here.
Oh, okay.
During the Hurricane Harvey.
And so while he was here?
While he was here, the warden here allowed me to see him. They let us go to a legal booth back there, and that's the first time I've seen him in 22 years, so it was pretty
So he's pretty down intense. On one of the Ramseys.
He's on the Terrell unit.
Terrell unit,
it used to be Ramsey 2 or 3. I'm not sure which one.
Terrell was Ramsey 2. I lived there.
Okay, so you've actually been there. It's all dorms, he said.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's 70. He's on a walker now, and he's still kind of fiery, a little bit fiery, though, but it's pretty emotional, you know, because it was the first time he got to look me in my eyes and tell me that he's sorry for ruining my life, you know. And, I told him that, you know, he'd long ago been forgiven. And,
right. And a lot of water under the bridge.
Yeah, it's no sense of holding
you
all
know,
that.
You know, I one time prevented Ramsey from getting flooded when a hurricane came in while I was maintenance and construction.
Some sandbags or something?
No, I built two burns, just piles of dirt. It didn't really stop the water, but it diverted the flow.
I don't think it got flooded this time, but the back gate, I think the warden said the back gate, maybe a couple of buildings had a little water, but otherwise it didn't get too
Terrell, bad. Terrell's actually a little lower than Ramsey 1.
So. Okay.
But Ramsey 1 is upstream on Oyster Creek. It's Oyster Creek that does that.
But my mom, she's having to go here and there. You know, it's been a crazy 22-plus years for her, you know, because all the men in her life went to prison. So, but yeah, she's a... I don't know. I'm not sure how she's doing, but
what do you hear from your brother?
We write, yeah. He seems to be. He was up for parole last month, so hopefully he made it. I don't know yet, but he seems to be doing okay.
They're being a little generous on parole these days, more than they have.
It's his second time. The first time we hired a parole attorney to represent him, but they denied him. But
whatever's in the file stays. People don't understand these parole attorney things. There are three levels of them, and if you don't get the top level, you're just rolling dice.
Right. And we got Nicole DeBoard. I don't know if you ever heard of her.
Nicole?
Yes.
Yeah,
Nicole. She charged pretty good rate.
Yeah. She's
pretty cheap.
She's middle run, and three tiers, and she's in the middle.
Right. She represented my attorney, David Dow, whenever they were trying to, you know, witch hunt him, you know, so.
Oh, well, David, you know, David is a survivor. He's a damn good lawyer. Thank you for giving him permission to talk to me.
Sure, no problem.
Because when I go back to Houston today, David and I are going to have a sit-down. And I'm going to talk to him and ask him some questions so I can better direct my attorneys on the prison show in your case.
Right.
Because the last show we did, I was not... They sound like a bunch of prosecutors to me.
They do. They sound like a bunch of... Except for Mike. Mike from Channelview. Mike from Channelview, I think.
Yeah,
He's definitely a guy. I mean, I'm not saying anybody's a bad guy on that show, but he's definitely...
Mike put in and defended the last guy.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He's definitely pro us.
Yeah.
Where is
Mike,
that?
Well, see, look who Mike deals with. He's down in Channelview. He deals with the Bandito. Channelview,
yep. I find that interesting. He probably knows a lot of the characters I used to run around with.
You'll hear me say, well, Mike, this could have been one of your cases.
Right? Yeah, you never know, right?
but I got on him, too. I mean, Mike and I talked back to the prosecutors.
I mean, I appreciate hearing both sides of a story.
Yeah.
I do. I appreciate that. And I understand that. But, I mean, you know, it is what it is. Most of the time when we're listening, you know, it's interesting to hear some of the details of the case. Yeah. But we know a lot of it anyways because a lot of us read their writs and stuff.
Sure.
But more than anything, we're curious about whether or not the person got to stay, you know, because that's going to come through y'all's show if it happens before 7 o'clock.
Oh, by the way, we're in the middle of fundraising.
So it won't be on back there?
No. The radio station, at my request, we're on the main studio on the air live.
Oh, okay.
If something happens in your case.
Oh, okay.
I hope the hell I don't even have to go to the station that day.
Right. Well, you never know, right? I mean, we've had so much good stuff in my case. I mean, if you can ask Dow, it's unbelievable. Clearly, we caught them with secret deals with inmates where the state made secret deals. There was junk science used to convict me. And we have an expert, a professor from the University of Virginia, that wrote a statement saying, hey, I reviewed the record. That's junk science.
Well, you know, whenever I talk about your case, more your case than other cases, because I've been to prison.
Right.
I know what it is like to, I'm going to go to rec and go to the gym. All right? You can't get out of there. Ain't no showers in there. You don't access your clothes in there.
Right.
And for you to show up at the front of that gym, spick and span, is just not physically possible given the nature of this case.
Right. No doubt.
It's just not physically possible.
If anybody with any sense looks at the physical details.
But they got to know how prison works.
Exactly. Yeah,
and unfortunately, they don't go down to the Ellis and pick jurors. That ain't how that works.
I think the defense and the state tried to build like a model for the jury to look at.
Yeah.
Something else that I don't know if we've ever talked about. I don't mean to digress, but the foreman of my jury.
This is your time. You can do anywhere you want.
The foreman of my jury, I don't know if I should say his name, but a man named Scott, foreman of my jury, he's written it, and I've had five jurors write similar things. And when the CCA denies you, or one of these courts deny you, they always say that, no, this new evidence, it wouldn't have changed the jury's verdict.
Yeah.
Well, I've got five jurors, and one of them's the foreman who's admitted to being a big influence to the other jurors, saying that, it would have. And the guy asked me to forgive him. He apologized for convicting me. He apologized for sending me to death.
Well, you got more going for you than just your good looks.
I'm just saying, there's a law that says that they don't have to consider juror statements.
No. No, actually, there's a law in Texas that says after you're executed, they cannot reopen your case to determine your innocence.
Crazy, right?
More than crazy.
I've ran it by Dale. I don't know if he's still pursuing it, but we're trying to pursue a different angle. I got this idea from Clinton Young, by the way, of trying to get the juror who made this statement to file a lawsuit himself and say, killing this person is going to be on my conscience.
That would be a good idea.
It's a totally different angle. I don't think anybody's ever tried it.
I don't think anybody's ever tried it. But you're right.
David Dow said the
execution
question
is so serious.
I mean, yeah, it's final. You
can't leave anything unturned.
No doubt.
You can't leave anything unturned.
And you would think that if they were going to kill people, I mean, I don't agree with the death penalty at all, but if they were going to kill people, they would know for sure that the person committed the crime.
Well, I come up here and I interview some pretty scary people. I think that I'll do something besides kill them. I mean, if that's all you got left in your arsenal, you need to do some more thinking.
Right. I'm just saying, you would think that they would know for sure that the person committed the crime. You know, that there would be something more concrete than look at the details of my case. There's nothing concrete about it.
And your case is so unusual because it happens in a vacuum society.
No doubt.
I mean, in order to convince, if I were sitting neutral on the jury, but I wouldn't be a good juror because I know how things happen in prison. But, been there, done that, lived that.
But people that haven't, they've already got this preconceived notion about prisoners.
Right.
So you're guilty the moment you're. I said you've got to prove them that you didn't do it.
Yeah.
You got to prove to them that
you didn't
do it.
Yeah, you're already there and you're already a convict, so.
And but they make the oath. The juror makes the oath. I promise I'm going to weigh the evidence. And they're human beings, man.
You're still smiling.
Well, I mean, you know, because I don't think. I mean, I have my own views of life and
death. Picking up a few Eastern ideas. How's that working?
I mean, I totally believe that there's a oneness of being. There's a one reality, and that energy never dies, and we're only going to transform.
Meditation's a wonderful too.
It definitely is. It's great exercise for staying in the moment.
Mark asked me.
This is actually.
Mark asked me, did you sleep well last night? I said, yeah, I just zenned it out and slept like a baby. Got up this morning and I'm in a whole new world.
Believe it or not, I sleep great. That's the one thing, because I've been on death watch so many times and I've seen guys that have a hard time sleeping. And I don't have a problem with that. That's one thing that I do. I sleep and I value my sleep, you know, so.
You can thank them Eastern ideas. You know where I learned that?
I mean, you know, I'm centered. I'm pretty centered. I don't think it's just.
When I was in prison, there was a book with a black and yellow cover. It said Zen for Dummies.
Okay.
And I read that.
And it's worked out
for
you.
Took it to heart.
It's worked out for you. That's good.
I want to leave you with a smile, and you're smiling. Can we cut this interview off?
Sure.
Thank you.
Now you know Robert Pruitt. Maybe not as well as I know him, But when this comes out in a couple of weeks in a video form for Houston Media Source, you'll be able to see Robert during that interview. Mike, you've met guys like this.
I am honored that a man like Robert Pruitt has mentioned my name.
He likes you.
I am now proud of the fact that I work in Channelview. I came to Channelview in 1994 when the first flood happened. I was already retired from my law practice, but I saw people out there without looking for help, getting out in the mud, cleaning their houses, and had no help. And I went out there, and I've been a lawyer in Channelview for 20 years. And in all the times I practiced law, there's very rare I see a case that I really feel that this man is innocent. And I want to mention just three facts. And these three facts, I'm convinced, will convince anybody he's innocent. And the first fact is that we know that Mr. Nagel was set to testify before the grand jury concerning corruption between prison guards and inmates running drugs. We know that. In fact, we know that afterwards he was indicted and people were indicted for these things. What this jury didn't know was that the Texas Observer had written an article in which they claimed that before Nagel's death, a note was found in prison from one inmate to another indicating that prison gangs had given a contract on Officer Nagel and he was to be killed. How come that's not out there? That there was actually a physical note talking about a contract by prison inmates against Officer Nagel when Officer Nagel is then deceased. Number one fact. Number two facts. As Ray said, that rec area was a rec area where there were, I think, at least four inmates. The area where the guard was killed was a half wall. Everything is in the open. Nobody saw anything. The man who did find the body, when he found the body and understand prison protocol, when a crime is committed, the officer who is reported to is in charge of the investigation. When the inmate found a body stabbed 9 times, instead of making an alarm, he ran to the gate and got released to the hallway to go to another gate. He passed control booths. He passed 3 different guards to find the one guard to report it to, who happened to be the guard who was later indicted
for the prison corruption.
Yeah.
How can we not look at this as being relevant? And nobody in that gym saw anything that day? Not till afterwards their trial do inmates come forth and testify that they saw anything? After the trial, one of the inmates who testified, a man named Henry Mitchell, testified that he felt so guilty about testifying against Robert Pruitt that he made a statement and said that he only testified because he was told unless he testified they were going to charge him with the murder, and in return for testimony he would be transferred from Texas to Virginia, his home, so his family can visit him. We're talking about reasonable doubt. Each one of those is reasonable doubt. We're not even talking about the blood splatter, and let's talk about the most important element. Robert Pruitt was in a uniform with his name on it when the day started. He only has one uniform with his name on it. That uniform had no evidence of the guard's blood was on there. He supposedly stabbed the man 9 times with a rebob, and there was blood all over the body and all over the bathroom, but there was none on the man who was, there was testimony that they were wrestling, they were fighting, and yet there wasn't a drop of blood on Mr. Nagel. How can that possibly be? He's innocent.
He's also
the murderer is a case, is the state of Texas who's murdering Robert Pruitt.
That's true. Paige, how have we handled your case?
Well, I mean, we've done our very best. Unfortunately, we are in the position where we have people across the road, and so we know how that always turns out.
Very good chance that Robert Pruitt is already dead. Larry?
That was a pretty shocking interview, Ray, to hear him, the way he spoke.
You could hear the smile. in his words.
And his level of maturity, his level of understanding, his perspective was really it gets to you. I am convinced from what I've seen that he appears not to have gotten a fair trial. That's my concern. You would expect a trial like this to at least have a diagram of what the surroundings looked like. I think that would have been focused on, but more particularly the whole story of the word on the yard. Okay, that the prosecutor was able to get that his story in completely, and Pruitt's lawyers were just shut down on every attempt that they made to get in to develop their case from a defensive standpoint. And I'm concerned that the appellate court did not. I'm concerned that the level of relief that he was granted was just horrible. Clearly the judge has discretion to let in evidence and not let in evidence, but it appears that his lawyers seem to have not been able to put on their case, to put on their defense, and that concerns me.
Well, you're all lawyers. Paige, what does it feel like if you were in the trial lawyer's position?
I would feel like I was surrounded by a football team, prevented from moving any more than 2 yards in any direction. It is obvious that the internal prison corruption played a strong role in this entire case, and that caused Nagel's murder. But if internal prison corruption was the direct, indirect cause of Nagel's murder, then it has become the direct cause of Pruitt's death. And it's so heartrending.
Larry, how do you think David Dow feels right now? He's the appellate lawyer, and he's challenged to fight with a stick too short, and it didn't work.
And unfortunately, there's such a limit of what you can do on appeal, because the real action is at the trial court level. And these kinds of cases really require someone to dig, like a Craig Washington did in the Eroy Brown case. You've just got to try every little thing. I mean, it's trial in Beeville, Texas. Can you get a change?
In a prison community town.
And that's one of the first things Craig did, is just move this thing. Luckily, moved it to Galveston.
Moved it to Galveston for 2 trials, and then we went to Edinburgh.
now, whether any of that was tried, I don't know. But there's just so much that has to be done.
The hours we spent, Craig got up and cooked breakfast every morning, and the hours of the defense team spent going over every little detail and writing the play that becomes the defense in the trial. I was playwright, and so we did that.
But trying this case in Beeville and in a prison town, and then being shut down by the judge on such a regular basis on putting forth a basic defense, That concerns me. That I'm just not comfortable that Pruitt got a fair trial. I'm just not, and it just seems to me that not only that it appears that he didn't get a fair trial. I'm not comfortable even with the appellate procedure. Dow is a great lawyer, but there's so little that you can do on. Sometimes you can't do a lot on appeal because the real action is the trial.
He's playing with other people's toys.
And he
was stuck with the facts that were made in the trial court, and it's just heartrending.
Well, Mike, we're down to you.
Just the fact that 5 jurors changed their mind, and the witnesses testifying against him testified afterwards that they did not tell the truth. should be a grounds for a retrial no matter what. I don't care what technicalities you talk about. When six of the people there, including five of the jurors and the foreman, have regrets of what they did, we don't need an appellate court to say we need a new trial. The jurors should be enough to give them a new trial.
I believe the standard for introducing newly discovered evidence is clear and convincing. Isn't that correct?
Well, that's the standard. But then, of course, the state is going to claim that it's not convincing. I don't care how many people are convinced.
Of course.
5 or 12 is clear and convincing enough to me.
It's clearing. It's convincing. Five.
And that final appellate issue of actual innocence that we talked about earlier, so much of the actual innocence evidence that might have been available, it's kind of hard to argue that it wasn't available at the time of trial.
Sure.
It's just a matter of pushing and getting it through. And I'm not criticizing the lawyers who tried the case, but it just seemed as though they were shut down a lot. And that concerns me.
But an example, I have found in my experience that whenever I have won an arson case, as soon as we get a settlement, within 6 months my client is indicted because they talk about the case once it's over.
Yeah.
Sometimes the truth comes out after a verdict. Sometimes after a verdict decides who did it, everybody starts talking.
Well, theoretically, that's what appeals are supposed to be about, right?
But only they're about it if the predicates are laid properly to bring it up.
Yeah, the appellate lawyer is playing with other people's toys, and that's not an easy game to play.
And you're playing in a system that so values finality. The system that we work in tries to get to a final result in every single case. And so we do have a tendency in the system to ignore a lot of things just for the sake of that finality, saying it's decided. And unless something is presented that shows that there was a clearly erroneous result, we're going to leave it just like it is.
But there shouldn't be finality in a death penalty case.
The witnesses have come out. Robert Pruitt is dead. Go ahead, Mike.
I don't know what to say. We have done a lot of shows, and the issue is not guilt or innocence. The issue is, should this person get the death penalty? And we argue many times that this person did not deserve the death penalty. But this is a case where I don't even understand. We're not even talking about why he got 99 years or 15 years old. We're talking about the evidence. Just the blood splatter enough is overwhelming to me that he couldn't have done it.
I'm going to exercise my prerogative. I reserve a little time for me to do a little editorializing. And that's what I think I do best, is editorialize. It's just my opinion. May not be important to you or anybody else, but you're out there and you've got your headphones on or your speakers on, so you're stuck with it. You'll have to take it for what it's worth, and you can do with it what you can do. I hate this show. I hate doing this show. I come down here every time we do a show because I think there is a journalistic obligation for journalists to take lights where none others are shined and put a light on the cockroaches that are about the business of killing people on the state's nickel. I'm not going to stop doing it. I'm going to keep on doing it. But I'm going to admonish you out there in the universal ether. Redouble your efforts. This is a call to arms. They killed my friend, who I believe and was substantially convinced simply on the facts, was innocent. This is a case where the state murdered someone that I personally knew or had come to know. And I've got the videotapes of the development and the growth of our friendship and how easy it was to be absolutely an advocate for Robert Pruitt. But it's not about Robert Pruitt, because Clint is coming up in just a few days. Clint Young is scheduled to be executed. he's got some things going on at a lower court, and it's new issues that are being looked at for the first time, and he's convinced that it'll work. But when I went to see Robert, there was Clint, who I had interviewed the last trip, sitting in one of the cell blocks to be interviewed by John Grasich of the Houston Chronicle in the AP News. You'll read John's story in the morning. And they're doing a documentary about John, and he chose Clint to be the guy he had his picture taken with. Clint's listening to the show about the death of his friend. And Clint, I feel so helpless. I feel so weak. I'm a pretty smart guy. I can sue cops and get cases in the Supreme Court and mega organizations that elect politicians. I can do a lot of stuff. But the Grim Reaper has got the best of me. I want the rest of you to feel what Clint and I are feeling right now. Your friend has been murdered by the state. What the hell are you going to do about it? My name is Ray Hill, and I am the host of the prison of the Execution Watch show. The producer is sitting on the other side of the glass, Elizabeth Stein. This would not have happened without the good work of Elizabeth. Robert's got his hands on the board. Otis is sitting out there to make sure that we went over the internet well, and he's also going to keep us going over the internet with future programs. In addition to that, Mark Pirtle's in the room. He's made a film of tonight's show, which will be spliced with the interview filmed of Robert Pruitt and will be played on HMS, and of course will be ensconced on executionwatch.org. If you haven't found that website, everything we've ever done is on that website. We pick music from Victoria Panetti, and she plays a hell of a song because her brother is mentally incapacitated on death row, awaiting his turn. My name is Ray Hill. This is radio station KPFT Houston. Good night.
Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're